A man queuing in a late-night takeaway is jostled by another customer. He turns and punches him once in the face, meaning to teach him a lesson, not to injure him seriously. The customer falls backwards, strikes his head on the curb, and dies. He is charged with murder. The jury is sure he caused the death unlawfully, and equally sure he never intended to kill or to cause really serious harm. So, is it murder? No. Is it nothing? Also no. This is manslaughter, and the topic runs on two tracks. Did the defendant have the mens rea for murder? If yes, look for a partial defense. If no, look for involuntary manslaughter. Ask that question first, and every homicide problem sorts itself. Keep our man in the queue. He comes back. Here is the route. First, the structure and why the two tracks matter. Then track one. Voluntary manslaughter, loss of control, then diminished responsibility. Then track two. Involuntary manslaughter, unlawful act, then gross negligence. Then drug deaths, which sit awkwardly between them. And last, corporate manslaughter. Manslaughter is the unlawful killing of a human being under the king's peace, without the malice aforethought that murder requires. Same actus reus as murder, lower mens rea. And one difference that matters in the exam. Murder carries a mandatory life sentence. Manslaughter carries a maximum of life, but it is discretionary, so the judge passes whatever the offence merits. Track one is voluntary manslaughter. The defendant did have the mens rea for murder, intent to kill or to cause really serious harm, but a partial defense reduces the conviction. There are two you need. Loss of control, under sections 54 and 55 of the Coroners and Justice Act 2009, which replaced the old defense of provocation. And diminished responsibility, under section 2 of the Homicide Act 1957, as substituted by section 52 of the 2009 Act. And the burdens differ, which is a favorite. On loss of control, the defendant only raises enough evidence to make it a live issue. The prosecution must then disprove it beyond reasonable doubt. On diminished responsibility, the defendant carries the legal burden and must prove it on the balance of probabilities. Same courtroom, two very different jobs. Loss of control has three requirements, and all three must be met. The defendant lost self-control. The loss had a qualifying trigger, and a person of the defendant's sex and age, with a normal degree of tolerance and self-restraint, might have reacted in the same or a similar way. Take them in turn. First, the loss itself. It need not be total, and section 54, subsection 2, says expressly that it need not be sudden. That is a deliberate break from the old law, which bore harshly on defendants who endured prolonged abuse before finally reacting. A slow burn, building over weeks or years, can still be a loss of self-control. But there is a catch, and it is evidential. The longer the gap between trigger and killing, the harder it is to persuade a jury the defendant lost control rather than decided to kill. And section 54, subsection 4, excludes a considered desire for revenge outright. Time to cool off, then a decision to kill, is not a loss of self-control. It is a calculated killing. Second, the qualifying trigger. Section 55 gives two, and a combination is possible. Fear of serious violence from the victim, or circumstances of an extremely grave character causing the defendant a justifiable sense of being seriously wronged. Read the fear trigger carefully. Three limits hide in the wording. Serious violence, not violence generally. Against an identified person, so a vague fear of some unknown attacker will not do. And from the victim, not a third party. Notice what is absent. Nothing requires the violence to be imminent, which is what makes this trigger available to someone who kills an abuser when no attack is underway. The second trigger has two parts, and both must be met. The circumstances must be objectively of an extremely grave character, and the defendant's sense of being seriously wronged must be justifiable. A trigger need not come from one incident either. Years of controlling and coercive behavior can amount to circumstances of an extremely grave character. A final remark that looks trivial alone takes its gravity from everything before it. Now, the exclusion to no cold. Section 55(6) C provides that sexual infidelity is not capable of being a qualifying trigger. Not on its own, and not as part of a combination. So if the scenario is a husband who kills his unfaithful wife, the infidelity gives him nothing. But look at what else the victim did. The exclusion removes the infidelity. It does not remove everything else the same person did. One more. Under Section 55, Subsection 6, Paragraph A and B, a trigger is disregarded so far as the defendant incited it to have an excuse for violence. Merely starting the confrontation does not bar the defense. What defeats it is engineering the victim's reaction to manufacture a pretext. Third requirement, the normal person test, and note the word might. The jury need not be sure a normal person would have reacted that way, only that one might. A low threshold, and the circumstances are judged as the defendant perceived them. Note what shapes that normal person. Sex and age. Nothing else lowers the self-restraint expected. Not drink, not cultural background, not a personality disorder. But a characteristic can still show how grave the trigger was for this defendant. So the question is never included or excluded. It is which question? Gravity of the trigger or capacity for self-restraint? Diminished responsibility next, and this one is about the defendant alone. Nothing to do with what the victim did. Section 2 of the Homicide Act 1957 gives four elements. An abnormality of mental functioning arising from a recognized medical condition, which substantially impaired the defendant's ability to do one of three things, and which provides an explanation for the killing. The three abilities are in Section 2, 1A. Understanding the nature of your conduct, forming a rational judgment, exercising self-control. Only one needs to be substantially impaired, so the defense can succeed even where the defendant knew exactly what they were doing if they could not stop themselves. A recognized medical condition means one recognized by the profession and properly diagnosed. Depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, personality disorders, brain injury. Battered woman syndrome is not a label to assert on its own. The medical evidence must identify the specific condition it produced in this defendant and explain how it impaired one of those three capacities. Voluntary intoxication is not a recognized medical condition. A binge drinker who kills during a heavy session cannot found the defense on the drink. That something appears in a diagnostic manual does not decide it. Whether it counts for Section 2 is a question of law, but do not overread that. An established alcohol dependency, where the drinking has stopped being truly voluntary, can qualify. And drink does not extinguish a condition the defendant already had. In the Crown against Dietschmann from 2003, the defendant had a pre-existing abnormality went out drinking, and killed. The House of Lords held the defence was still open. The question is whether the abnormality was a significant cause of the killing, even though the defendant was also drunk. Then the word that decides most of these cases, substantially. In the Crown against Golds from 2016, the Supreme Court held that substantial does not simply mean more than trivial. That set the bar too low and had been misleading juries. Substantial carries its ordinary meaning, important or weighty. It still does not have to be total. Track 2. Involuntary manslaughter, where the defendant never had the mens rea for murder. Three forms. Unlawful act manslaughter, sometimes called constructive manslaughter. Gross negligence manslaughter and corporate manslaughter. Hold the dividing line. Unlawful act manslaughter needs an underlying criminal offence, and gross negligence does not. Unlawful act manslaughter has four elements. An unlawful act, which is dangerous, which causes death, and the defendant has the mens rea for that underlying offence, not for the death. That is why it is constructive. No foresight of death is needed, or of any harm at all. Two things about that act. It must be a criminal offence, not a civil wrong, and it must be a positive act. An omission will not do here. It need not be an offence against the person either. Property offences count if they are dangerous, and arson of an occupied house qualifies.
So what makes an act dangerous?
In the Crown against Church from 1966, the defendant knocked a woman unconscious during an argument and threw her into a river where she drowned. The test still governs. The act must be such that all sober and reasonable people would inevitably recognize that it carried a risk of some physical harm. Objective. It does not matter what this defendant recognized, which takes us back to the takeaway cue. Punching someone in the face is a battery, so there is the unlawful act. Would every sober and reasonable person recognize that a punch to the face risks some physical harm? Obviously, and it caused the death. He never foresaw the curb or the bleed, and he did not have to. Unlawful act manslaughter. Now, drug deaths, which trip candidates constantly, ask first who performed the final act. In the Crown against Kennedy from 2007, the defendant prepared a syringe of heroin and handed it to the victim, who injected himself and died. The House of Lords quashed the conviction, where a fully informed and responsible adult freely self-administers that free, deliberate and informed act is what causes the death. That is a causation point, not a rule, that supplying drugs is never dangerous, and the supply offence remains chargeable. Ask second, did the defendant administer the drug or give it to someone incapable of an informed choice? Then the ordinary dangerousness analysis applies. Third question, and this is the one people miss. Did the defendant supply and then fail to get help once the danger was obvious? Look at gross negligence instead. In the Crown against Evans from 2009, the defendant supplied heroin to her sister, who became unconscious. Rather than call an ambulance, they tried to revive her themselves, and she died. Creating a dangerous situation can give rise to a duty to act, which brings us to gross negligence manslaughter. The framework is the Crown against Adamako from 1994. An anaesthetist failed to notice that the tube supplying oxygen to his patient had become disconnected during an eye operation. The patient died. The House of Lords upheld the conviction and set out the test still used today. Five elements. 1. The defendant owed the victim a duty of care on ordinary negligence principles. 2. The defendant breached it. 3. At the time of the breach, there was a reasonably foreseeable serious and obvious risk of death. 4. The breach caused the death. 5. The breach was so bad as to amount to a criminal act or omission. Element 3 is where the marks are. The risk must be of death, not of injury, not of something serious going wrong. And obvious means clear on what the defendant actually knew at the time. You ask it forwards, never with hindsight. An optometrist who negligently skipped examining a child's eyes was acquitted for exactly that reason. An apparently well child at a routine appointment presented no obvious risk of death. And element 5 sets a high bar, conduct falling far below the standard expected of a reasonable person. The jury must be sure the negligence went beyond even serious civil negligence. Breach plus death is a tort. It takes grossness to make it a crime. Last, corporate manslaughter under the Corporate Manslaughter and Corporate Homicide Act 2007. An organization is guilty where the way its activities are managed or organized causes death and amounts to a gross breach of a relevant duty of care. The breach must be attributable to the way senior management ran things. No individual director need be shown to have been personally negligent. A word on how SQE1 tests this. You will not be asked to recall a case name or a section number. You get a scenario, 5 answers, and 1 instruction. Pick the best. So, learn the elements as checklists and learn which way each rule cuts. The names are memory pegs, nothing more. If you keep only 3 pegs. The Crown against Church, where dangerousness is judged by what sober and reasonable people would inevitably recognize. The Crown against Adamako, which gives you the 5 stages of gross negligence. And the Crown against Kennedy, where handing a syringe to an adult who injects himself is not, in law, causing his death. 4 traps. 1. Sexual infidelity can never be a qualifying trigger. Not alone, not in combination. But the exclusion strips out the infidelity, not the rest of the victim's conduct. Always look for something else in the facts that might qualify. 2. Keep the burdens apart. On loss of control, the defendant only raises evidence, and the prosecution must disprove it beyond reasonable doubt. On diminished responsibility, the defendant must prove it. On the balance of probabilities. Get these the wrong way round, and you lose the mark. 3. In gross negligence, the obvious risk is a risk of death. A risk of serious injury is not enough, and you judge it on what the defendant knew at the time, never with the knowledge they would have gained from the very step they failed to take. 4. Do not reach for unlawful act manslaughter on an omission. It needs a positive criminal act. If the facts turn on a failure to act, a failure to call an ambulance, a failure to feed or treat, you are in gross negligence territory. Quick check. A man discovers his wife has been having an affair with a colleague. Going through the bank statements, he finds she has also been moving several thousand pounds a month into the colleague's account. The mortgage has gone unpaid for 4 months, and the lender is threatening possession. He confronts her that evening, loses his self-control during the argument, and strangles her. On what basis, if any, can a qualifying trigger be established? 3 candidates. 1. On the financial deception, since the infidelity cannot itself supply a trigger, though it may form part of the context. 2. On the infidelity and the financial deception taken together. 3. on no basis, since excluding sexual infidelity defeats any trigger arising out of the same relationship. Pause here if you want a moment. The answer is 1. Section 55, 6, C, requires the sexual infidelity to be disregarded, so the affair founds nothing. But the wife's conduct is not exhausted by the affair. Draining the joint account and putting the family home at risk of possession is separate conduct that is capable of being circumstances of an extremely grave character, giving him a justifiable sense of being seriously wronged. Why the others fail? Option 2 treats the two as a single combined trigger, which is exactly what the subsection forbids. The trigger has to stand on the financial conduct alone, though the infidelity may color how grave that conduct was. Option 3 overshoots. The exclusion removes the infidelity, not everything else the same person did. 5 things to take away. 1. Ask the murder question first. Mens rea for murder plus a partial defense is voluntary manslaughter. No mens rea for murder is involuntary. 2. Loss of control needs a loss of self-control, a qualifying trigger, and the normal person test. The loss need not be sudden, and sexual infidelity is never a trigger. 3. Diminished responsibility is an abnormality of mental functioning from a recognized medical condition, substantially impairing one of 3 capacities and explaining the killing, and the defendant must prove it. 4. Unlawful act manslaughter needs a dangerous crime, and dangerous means what sober and reasonable people would inevitably recognize. Our man in the queue foresaw nothing, and it made no difference. 5. Gross negligence needs a duty, a breach, a serious and obvious risk of death, judged without hindsight, causation, and conduct bad enough to be criminal. Next time, theft. Practice this topic with exam-style questions at sqe1prep.co.uk. This episode is for education and exam revision only, not legal advice, and we are not affiliated with or endorsed by the SRA or Kaplan.